tells Congress and it tells this administration that they are not in line with much of American public opinion. I think it's a much needed message.
Josh Paul, veteran State Department official who worked on arms deals and resigned in October in protest of a push to increase arms sales to Israel amidst the attack on Gaza. Visit democracynow.org to see all of our coverage on Gaza and Israel. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, and Emily Anderson. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
This month, besides being the season of Thanksgiving, here at KBOO we celebrate Native American heritage. Tune in throughout the rest of the month for special programming hosted and produced by Native American creators, as well as programming highlighting Native American, First Nation, Indigenous, and Aboriginal cultures here on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
I'm Grace Gearing Medicine Eagle Reed. I am broadcasting Negotiating Dramatic Events, a new show on KBOO, the third Wednesday at 9 a.m. I am a social justice activist since the 1960s. The purpose of the show is to make life more wonderful for me and the people around me. And I'm 80, and I'm going to take my elderliness and share what I have found so that everybody can be seen, heard, and understood. Negotiating Dramatic Events, the third Wednesday at 9 a.m. Thanks for tuning in. Really appreciate KBOO.
KBOO.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week. This week's program is presented by Terrascope Radio, a class that is part of Terrascope, a sustainability-focused learning community at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT. Terrascope Radio teaches the basics of radio production to first-year students. I'm your host, Alisa Schaff, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Today on Sprouts, we'll hear stories directly from people we met during a class trip to the Navajo Nation, which is a sovereign nation located in the Four Corners region in the southwestern United States. But before we begin, what exactly is Terrascope, and why were you at the Navajo Nation? Terrascope is a learning community that tackles a different sustainability-related challenge every year. For our class year, we were presented with the issues of water and food insecurity in the Navajo Nation. Through Terrascope, we learned more about the issues at hand. And over spring break, we had an opportunity to meet some of the Diné people, or the indigenous people of the Navajo Nation. Many of them were willing to be interviewed, and we'll be hearing some of them speak today, along with the high winds that we encountered during our time there. In fact, all of the voices that you'll hear today, besides the student narrators, Jacqueline Perwira and Sheena Lowell, will be Diné.
And you hear that from Native people. Oh, everything is sacred. Look at the ground you touch is sacred. That river there is sacred. Those trees, the birds, look, feel the sun rays, it's sacred. It is! It truly, truly is!
This is Kevin Balin, one of the Diné people we met, who you'll be hearing more from later today. Why is everything imbued with sacredness? What does sacredness mean for him and other Diné people? We will explore ways seemingly everyday places and actions are sacred in Diné culture. We visit places like the meeting place of two rivers, a cornfield, and outdoor cooking pits to ask members of the Diné community from traditional chefs to farmers to educators, how they fill these places in their daily lives with the sacredness that Kevin describes. Join us on our journey across parts of northern Arizona and New Mexico to explore more about the Diné community and learn about this sacredness through their unique stories.
Yate, 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 yate. Thank you for coming. Thank you for being here.
That was Tony Goldtooth welcoming us in the Navajo language when we joined his family for an outdoor Navajo-style lunch. Why were we joining Tony? We were a group of first-year students from MIT, and we traveled to the Navajo Nation to, initially, learn about agriculture. But what we learned was so much more than that. We met truly amazing and inspiring Navajo people, or Diné, who showed us that agriculture was much more than just a job. It's a central tenet of their culture and identity as a people. One person we met was Brandon Francis, a research technician at New Mexico State University, NMSU. He showed us around the NMSU Agricultural Experiment Station, where we got to see things like gardens of native plants, experimental vineyards, and the equipment he uses to conduct his research. At one point, Brandon stopped us to take in the landscape, looking down the path of tan, soft soil under our feet, an artificial grove of poplar trees, now brown and bare, walled off the landscape to our left, while paler brown but equally bare fields waiting for growing season stretched off to our right. Perfectly framed between the two, seeming to mark the end of our dirt path at the horizon, was the bluish silhouette of a far-off monolith named Shiprock. This geologic structure, a remnant of an ancient volcano, is deeply intertwined with the traditional stories of the Diné, and it is considered a sacred place. Obscuring the bottom half of Shiprock's profile was the chimney of a power plant, puffing short-lived white clouds.
This is what I call the perfect image of the reservation. You have a coal-fired power plant, you have a picture of agriculture, then you have Shiprock in the background. That's the what I like to say, the res in a pinon shell. Agriculture, coal-fired power plant, Shiprock, that's the res in one picture right there.
Brandon also took us to the confluence of the Animas and San Juan Rivers near Farmington, New Mexico. When we arrived, the winds chilled us to the bone, the spring sunshine in late March not yet warm enough to offer any relief. The San Juan River surface was a shimmering reflection of the sky, while the Animas River was a murky brown, mirroring the bare, overhanging cottonwood branches. When the rivers merged at the confluence, the water of the two rivers would flow in parallel lanes of color, only beginning to mix at their border, where the water encountered many islands of beige sand and rocks.
This is our temple. You know, we view this part as this land, its water as sacred, you know, providing life. And we pray right here, and we pray for things, because we always believe that water takes our prayers to the big water, down onto the Colorado, then it goes into the ocean, and eventually comes back to us, so it carries our prayers for us. And so every time we pray to the water. Not only do we view the river as a part of our family, but a part of our way of life. And when we grow things and we grow plants, we view them as our children, as our relatives. And when we're watering them or when we're tending to them, we always talk to them. No se chiyaja, you know, grow my little one, you know. And we treat them as family.
But what if the water is contaminated? We learned about the Gold King mine spill that happened in 2015, when a mine in Colorado spilled toxic wastewater into the Animas River, where it spread to the confluence and much of the San Juan River downstream, turning the water's caution tape yellow. Farmers relying on the San Juan River for water were forced to shut down their irrigation lines.
So when the Gold King mine spill happened, and they shut off the water, for a lot of Navajo people, for a lot of Diné people, it was like watching their relatives die out in the field and die of thirst, you know, wither and die.
After our stroll with Brandon along the river, we headed to the Lane family farm owned by Gloria and Harry Lane. Through the farm, Gloria and Harry aimed to teach Diné culture and traditional farming. The farm consists of a one-story house, painted a light tan that almost camouflaged with the surrounding soft khaki-colored soil. The house overlooks the San Juan River and a plot of farmland, which was clear of weeds when we visited, as the family prepared for the upcoming planting season. There, standing next to the field, we met Kevin Balin, director of the Dene Bazad Institute at the Navajo Preparatory School, who extended the ideas of sacredness Brandon mentioned earlier.
And you hear that from Native people. Oh, everything is sacred. Look at the ground you touch is sacred. That river there is sacred. Those trees, the birds, look, feel the sun rays, it's sacred. It is! It truly, truly is.
For Kevin, one particularly sacred plant is corn.
We were told that our bodies are made of corn. When we were created, we were told this is what our bodies were made of. This is how we are going to interact with the world around us. When you're creating a cornfield, you're creating life. When you plant that seed, sperm, right? Egg. When you're creating that field, you create your home.
To Brandon and Kevin, agriculture is not just a means to an end, a way to deliver food to the grocery store for the convenience of modern society. Even though there are challenges, waking up before the blazing sun rises and removing weeds in the blistering heat, practicing agriculture is a fundamental part of who they are as Dene people.
For us as Dene people, you have to have a passion for growing corn. You have to have the will, you have to have the motivation to come over here, look at this piece of dirt and think it's going to be productive. You have to have that mindset that this land here, I'm going to have to work it to ensure we have food.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interests. This week's program is brought to you by Terrascope Radio, a class that is part of Terrascope, a sustainability-focused learning community at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT. Terrascope Radio teaches the basics of radio production to first-year students. I'm your host, Alisa Shah, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We are currently exploring stories from the Navajo Nation and the Dene people who lived there. We ask how sacredness is imbued into their everyday lives. Brandon Francis and Kevin Balin, who we met earlier at the Lane family farm, told us how they view the connecting points of two rivers and the act of making a cornfield as sacred. Kevin had just described how it takes grit to grow corn. So what motivates the Dene to continue practicing agriculture? Next up is a story of one person who works on the Lane family farm.
And while some of us were listening to Kevin, others of us were talking to Gabrielle Henderson, also known as Gabby, a New Mexico State University undergraduate student who also volunteers her time at the Lane family farm. So why does she put in the time and effort to help with farming? It all started with Gloria and Harry's daughter, Nunaba Lane, who unfortunately passed away 6 months prior to us meeting the Lane family. But in her lifetime, Nunaba was an educator and environmental sustainability specialist who also became a role model for Gabby.
So how I personally got involved with this was through Nunaba. She's kind of been there for me since childhood, making cookies, and she's just a really, really outgoing person. Like, she would travel everywhere. She told me everything about it. And that was when I was a little kid. And then when I got into high school, I came more mature, I guess. Not really, but a little bit. And I got to know the way of, like, kind of like the farm. But then when Nunaba would tell me about, like, these opportunities and these stuff about the farm, I wouldn't be intrigued by it. I think about it, but then I was really, I don't have time for it, when really I did. And but now that when she passed, it's just like, it really affected me. So like, I needed to be more involved, and I wanted to do something more with my life, I guess.
So Gabby got her start in the place where we met her, the Lane family farm, currently managed by Nanaba's parents, Gloria and Harry Lane, and her brother Bruce Lane. And although we never got to meet Nanaba ourselves, she's continued to have an impact on those around her.
I was just like, yeah, I can do this for her. And I also noticed that the farm needed help because Gloria is kind of like getting old and Harry's getting old, and I was just like, I just need to help them. So I first started here. I would just come here for maybe 3 days a week for maybe a couple hours. But then Gloria got me connected with Dr. Lombard from NMSU. He works at the Agriculture Center, and I got an internship over there too. So I just started there, I think, December, and I'm learning new stuff.
And while the Lane Farm continues operating, both as a farm and the center of the Navajo Ethno-Agriculture Program, co-founded by Nanaba, Gabby is slowly but steadily making progress with her own projects in agriculture.
I'm learning pruning, and I'm learning seed planting with different like experimental seeds, I guess.
While Gabby is working on growing food, others are working on how to get the food from the farm to the table.
We're very happy that you all came out to visit us today here at our new little farm area where we're going to be putting together some new and exciting things, hopefully.
Danielle Goldtooth and her partner Alan Moore became involved in food sovereignty and traditional Navajo cuisine because of one particular food, hamburgers.
He likes telling this story, but I'll tell it this time. We were cruising through Phoenix, and we were stopping off at a burger joint to, you know, get a hamburger, and it's a local place, maybe about a year ago or so. And we go in, and they're like, "Well, we don't have any beef." And we're like, we have supply chain issues. And we're coming from working as a slaughterwoman and a butcher. So we were very befuddled. We're like, we just came out from where these people can't even sell all of their cows right now. What's going on here? How am I not having beef, you know, 50 miles away from where I'm also processing this? Something here is not right. Why is this not closer to home? Why are we not having beef where we should be having it?
But it wasn't just a supply chain issue. Danielle and Alan also noticed that the farmers in their area were getting older.
A lot of our elderly are still farming, but our middle-aged people and our younger people are not. And so it is our hope by coming back to this space that we're able to help revitalize, but also help demonstrate that the Diné way of life and the way that we have had our communities put together with the basis of agriculture is a way that we can continue to move forward in this newer world using technologies that are going to be helpful, not just for ourselves, but for the earth. So that's kind of our mission. Alan and I have our own food company called DNF Food Start to Finish.
Their business produces traditional Navajo food, starting at their own farm and finishing at the table. They hosted us for lunch near where their farm is located, and we arrived just in time to watch the final preparations for the food. Racks of mutton hissed and spat on a grill over a fire, outsides charring to form a dark brown-black crust. Bags of vegetables tumbled into woks, sizzling on contact with the hot metal. Ears of corn and foil-wrapped potatoes were buried all around smoldering embers dusted with ashes. Interestingly, all this cooking was executed on the ground. Pits had been dug out and structured into a cooking area using stone blocks, which pots, pans, and metal grill grates were set over. And as we waited, we learned that these particular stones actually held special value for Danielle and her family.
What we were doing this week in preparation for you all to be here, the first thing that we actually did was we took down an old little oven, and all of these little rocks that are here, or the big rocks were here, were actually quarried by our forefathers. This specific one was probably from our great-great-great-great-grandfather's Hogan, and they hand quarried these stones themselves. And this used to be a part of a Hogan, a traditional Navajo home out near the Shiprock Rock area. As the years have gone by, we've reused these stones over and over for fire pits or for our cooking adobes and such.
As the intense winds blew wood smoke and the mouth-watering aromas of grilling meat, stir-fried vegetables, and roasted corn toward us, Danielle introduced the menu for the day, consisting of traditional Navajo recipes made using farm-fresh ingredients.
This is what we would love to offer you. We have a Three Sisters soup for our vegetarian folks. We have I believe it's going to be anasazi beans with a split pea, yellow pea, pinto beans, and a few other beans that you would have found in this area that were traditionally brought here by and cultivated by the Anasazi themselves. For those of you who are our meat eaters, the other thing that's special about these ribs is my grandmother went and she picked out chichin, which is a red berry sumac.
And the food was delicious. Before we left, we asked Danielle about the significance of her work.
I imagine that our impact is going to be very small, but that's okay. As long as we're doing this for our community and we have our hearts in it, that's what matters to us.
It seems that it's not just the surrounding land that is sacred for the Diné people we met. They also place purpose in their actions and how they pursue their goals. So what seems immediately ordinary and everyday, such as farming, could hold deeper and richer meanings. Reflecting back on the trip, this idea was definitely something that resonated with each of us. We couldn't help thinking about our own lives. Why do we do the things that we do? And what, if any, is the greater meaning in our everyday actions?
As we end this program, there are additional quotes that felt powerful to us from the Diné people we met that we would like to share with you. While we were on the Lane family farm listening to Kevin talk about agriculture, we found that Kevin gave us lessons that are more applicable to our lives as non-farmers than we expected. For example, when Kevin talked about weeding, it was actually about procrastination, something all too familiar to us as college students.
Then one of the biggest things that farmers and even the Lanes have, they always ask, we need people to weed. If you allow those weeds to come in and enter, even for a little bit, you say, oh no, we'll get to it 2 days from now. These weeds don't take it easy, right? In a day or two, these things explode. It can get to where it's uncontrollable. It gets to a point where you're like, forget it.
Another thing Kevin made us consider was how we make decisions in our everyday lives. When it comes to making tough choices, what should we choose?
To be the Diné, to be in balance with earth and sky, it takes a lot of weight. Constantly, as you go through life, you're going to have choices. In the Bilagana or Anglo way of thinking, there's right and wrong, right? Clear choices, right and wrong. Is any decision ever that easy? No. So what we as Diné people say, you either take the right path or the easy path. The easy path is generally something that's not going to have the best consequences, right? If you take the easy way of doing things, are you going to learn from those mistakes? Are you going to learn from those challenges or obstacles? Probably not.
Kevin then goes on to tell us how much corn is needed to start a cornfield and the significance of that.
Some of our homes, you'll see corn is strung up 4 to 6. And we're told that even in times of war and even in times of hardship, if the 6 corn that we saved, that'll still give us enough to restart a cornfield. And generally, our families would keep them in the home. They'd even hide them in certain places in the rocks if need be. And 6 ears of corn was what we were told at least can restart back a farm.
Kevin speaks to core Diné values and how they would prepare for the worst case scenarios. As long as they have these ears of corn, they are able to persevere and restart their farms.
At the Lane family farm, we were also able to meet Adriano Sinigini, a biologist and board member of Navajo Ethno-Agriculture. He talked to us about how the Diné people came to be.
So we have our creation story. We have four different worlds. We're in the fourth one now. The third world, there was a flood that happened. So during that flood, when that flood was occurring, the turkey, who is an inhabitant of that world, knew the flood was coming. So he started collecting all these different type of plants and seeds, corn seeds, squashes, a lot of domestic and, wild flowers and wild plants and seeds. So he brought that into this world. So when we came to this world, there was nothing. It was kind of just like a blank canvas. And so they're like, we didn't even think about bringing food with us. So the turkey was smart enough and he dropped all the plants and said, this is for the people. You guys take care of it. So that's why today we utilize agriculture in our everyday lifestyle.
And we were also able to speak to Bruce Lane, Harry and Gloria's son, who gave us a look into how much knowledge the older generation holds regarding farming by comparing his ability to grow watermelons with his mother's.
Well, I think, they have all the older knowledge, My mom, she taught us how to plant corn. You plant corn in fours, you plant corn for the earth, for the sky, for the animals, and for us. So you kind of, the creatures. And then she knows how to grow melons and how to watering the water schedule for them. I don't, if it were me, I would have overwatered them, but she'll hit it with water and say, okay, leave it alone. Then, a week later or something, hit it again and say, okay, now we'll leave it alone for the rest of the season. I'm like, they're watermelons. Shouldn't they dry out? And they're like, no, they know what they're doing, And it's a lot of internal knowledge that she has. I try to pay attention to it and pick up on it. But growing melons isn't easy.
When joining Danielle for lunch near Shiprock, New Mexico, we were also able to talk to some other members of the Diné community. One of them was Lula Sandoval, an 86-year-old farmer who not only owns the land, but still personally works it herself.
What's the best part of your day?
Everything.
As we close out our trip, we met Shandera Coleman, who worked at the Navajo Nation Museum in Window Rock, the Navajo Nation's capital. And she gave us a cool snippet of Diné culture in relation to home.
With us, they say the same that, with our culture, that if you bury, our umbilical cord, that will always come back home to it. So it's like you always find your way back home. And usually that's buried on your property, where you live at home.
We came on this trip with the goal of learning from the Diné people. We wanted to understand how they see the world around them, along with their struggles and aspirations. As the Terrascope Radio class, we aimed to share these stories to the world and give our audience a glimpse into what the Navajo Nation and its people are like. For us, what made this trip unforgettable was not just the enthralling views of Shiprock and the confluence of the Animas and San Juan Rivers, or even the delicious mutton ribs, but rather getting a glimpse into the hearts of the people that we met. This show was produced by the Spring 2023 MIT Terrascope Radio class. Sheener Lowe, Jacqueline Prawira, Nevena Stojkovic, and Elisa Shah. The Terrascope Radio class is a part of MIT Terrascope, a learning community for first-year undergraduate students focused on solving complex environmental problems. The class was developed in collaboration with MIT's Comparative Media Studies program. We would like to thank the members of the MIT Terrascope community, Director David McGee, Community Coordinator Michelle Contos, and Associate Director and Lecturer Ari Epstein. Ari Epstein is also our instructor for Terrascope Radio, along with the Undergraduate Teaching Fellows Richard Chen and Athena Wong, who gave much support and feedback throughout the class. We would also like to thank everyone who made the Terrascope Spring Break trip possible. Joel Grimm, Libby Shu, Ben Tiger, and Vippy Yi, as well as the people who talked to us throughout our trip. Steve Semkin, Danielle Goldtooth and Alan Moore, Tony and Cora Goldtooth, Lula Sandoval, Brandon Francis and Karen Denny, Kevin Lombard, Adriano Sinigi, Gabrielle Henderson, Gloria, Harry, and Bruce Lane, Bree Lehmerman, Dean Dempsey, Cindy Howe, and Daryl Jones. Without these amazing and wonderful people, this program would have truly been impossible. Music from Blue Dot Sessions. Thank you for listening.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to MIT Terrascope Radio's Spring 2023 piece, Yate, Everything Here is Sacred. Our contributors this week were members of MIT Terrascope Radio's Spring 2023 class, Shinar Luo, Jacqueline Perwira, Nevena Stokovich, and Alisa Xia. Production assistance came from Ari Epstein, Associate Director and Lecturer for MIT Terrascope, and undergraduate teaching fellows, Athena Wong and Richard Chen. Music you heard included Avira, Jodan, Across the Table, Hope in the Forester, and Aruru from Blue Dot Sessions. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Alisa Xia in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to Community Radio KBOO 90.7.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience, produced at a different location every week. I'm Colleen MacDonald from Got Science, a podcast by the Union of Concerned Scientists. Today on Sprouts, what traditional ecological knowledge can teach us. Dr. Daniel Wildcat explains how traditional ecological knowledge can work in tandem with science to help us understand the natural world. I hope this doesn't sound blasphemous from someone working at a science-based organization, but science isn't the only way to make sense of the world. It's just one way that turns out to be pretty reliable. But there are other ways, and science can coexist and even complement these other ways of understanding our world. One such way is traditional ecological knowledge, the evolving knowledge acquired by indigenous and local peoples over hundreds or thousands of years through direct contact with the environment. I was lucky enough to hear Dr. Daniel Wildcat, a professor at Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas, speak about traditional ecological knowledge, or TEK, earlier this summer. And I feel even luckier that as a podcast host, I was able to get him to continue this conversation with me. Dr. Wildcat is the co-director of the Haskell Environmental Research Studies Center, an author, and an accomplished scholar who writes about indigenous knowledge, technology, the environment, and education. He's a Yuchi member of the Muscogee Nation of Oklahoma through a twist of federal tribal classification fate that we'll get into in our conversation. He joined me to talk about people's lived experiences and observations, TEK in concert with climate science, how much has been lost by the genocide and colonization and whitewashing of indigenous people, culture, and language, and how we should never pass up the opportunity to celebrate nature and its beauty. Dr. Wildcat, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, it's really great to have you here. You're a Yuchi member of the Muscogee Nation.
Yes.
What would you like our listeners to know about the Yuchi people?
Well, we could do a whole program on this, so I'll give you the short version. The Yuchi, as we would refer to ourselves in our language, Zoyaha, I am Zoyaha, a Yuchi person, a child or people of the sun. We were one of the small groups of people, nations, that were in the southeastern United States, along with the Chickasaws, Choctaws, Cherokees, Seminoles, and obviously our Muscogee relatives. And as you know from history, at the time of removal, we were pretty well decimated. We had really been hit by European diseases, victims of all the dysfunction that went along with the rum trade and that kind of thing. And so at the time of removal, we were really included as a part of this Creek Confederacy, the Muscogee Confederacy. So we've never been recognized independent of the Muscogee people, although we know we're different. We have our own language. We share some things, quite a few things, as you might imagine, culturally, given we came from the same area and our cultures were very much embedded in the places we called home. But the Yuchis were never recognized independent of the Muscogee Nation or Creek Nation of Oklahoma. So I always jokingly tell people they've heard of federally recognized tribes, they've heard of state recognized tribes. The Zoyaha are a federally misrecognized tribe. We're recognized as part of the Muscogee Nation. And we got a lot of relatives, good relatives we're thankful that we have, but we are a distinct people with a culture and our own language.
Great. Well, thank you for that explanation, because I think it's important to recognize the differences and the many different tribes and the richness of all of them.
Yeah, thank you for asking.
I want to talk today about traditional ecological knowledge. I wonder if you could give a definition.
Well, here's the interesting thing. I don't know that there's a agreed upon definition, and that might not be a bad thing. But I'll give you a definition that I have distilled from the incredible people I've worked over the last 3.5 decades as a result of being at Haskell Indian Nations University, the kind of de facto tribal university in the United States. I always tell people that TEK is knowledge. Traditional ecological knowledge is knowledge that was born of a long historical symbiotic relationship between a particular people and a particular landscape. There's no mistake about it that the way in which particularly our physical and material cultures were representative of, they came really from those places. Our food, our clothing, the materials in which we built our houses and our forms of lodging from, all came from a particular place. This was pre the mega big box stores where you go to get everything. So we went out, you know, into the land around us, into the forest, on the lakes, if you're on the coast, on the oceans. So TEK ultimately is knowledge that is held by people because of their long-standing interaction with a particular landscape or seascape. And it is transferred intergenerationally through stories, ceremony, song, and actual ways in which people went about living, customs and habits. So really, that's what traditional ecological knowledge is. It's very practical. It's very much centered around particular peoples and their relationship to a particular place.
If there was a problem in your community, say a blight on a species of tree or dying off of a species or animal, how would that be handled? Do you adapt to that, or do you take a corrective action?
Well, I think that would depend. In the case where this is something that you've experienced before, it might be very likely that people have figured out a way to address a particular blight, or maybe you've got a particular kind of insect infestation in some plants. People have ways of treating that. It's usually a result of, again, having this long-standing body of knowledge that gets handed down that, oh, in this case, you know, it may be just the issue of maybe you mix some water with a particular substance from another plant and use that as an insecticide. And so it really depends. There might be times when you face something that you've never seen before or have no record of. That's probably the kind of thing where, you know, people have to just say, well, okay, we've got to really think about this. And in some cases, the decision might be made to not do anything or just consult with the people in the university land-grant institutions and their extension departments and say, hey, this is something we've never seen, but maybe you have. So we're always, Indigenous people are not afraid of looking for new information and new knowledge. That's kind of, I think, one of the things that we have to disabuse people of. I think one of the fascinating things about traditional ecological knowledges are that they are very practical, lifeway oriented, and you're constantly prepared and taught to look for new evidence, new information that you can get. And obviously, before we go to the library, we want to look around that particular environment that we're in. So we might say something showing up on our plants. Well, what has happened in the larger landscape that our garden's a part of? And so again, it's that very systemic interrelationship that I think is what, to me, is very fascinating about traditional ecological knowledges.
So is there a difference from how a scientist would do field work or do observations in their field work? How is it different?
Yeah, I think it's probably different in this respect. I think if you're in a classic field work setting, you might be building your trisect areas of a particular grassland or a forest, and you're counting species within a given area. What's the diversity in this and that? And I think for people, that might be useful for people who were unfamiliar with that place. But that would never occur as a, quote, methodology that a holder of traditional ecological knowledge would have because of their familiarity with the place.
So then how would you describe the differences between traditional ecological knowledge and Western science?
My good friend and mentor, Vine Deloria Jr., used to say, here's one of the interesting distinctions between Western science and TEK. Western science is kind of looking always for those general laws, those general kinds of principles that you can apply, or what are the building blocks of knowledge that are commonly shared, or even of a physical world. And Deloria said, because of the way we were related to the land, to the air, to the water around us, that our methodology was to pay close attention to the changes that we saw, because changes, those things that were unexpected, anomalies, were the things we paid the most attention to. Where he says, you know, Western science is always kind of saying, well, we don't care about the anomalies. Maybe that was an experimental error. We're just trying to look for the general, the universal kind of knowledge that we can share here. And Deloria was saying, well, you know, the attitude of Indigenous knowledge holders was all experience is useful, but particularly when you saw those things that changed, that were different, then you made note, because then you had to set about figuring out what's going on. Is this good? Is it bad? Is it okay? And I think that's really important. And I think there are probably today field scientists who do something similar to that.
Yeah, it seems like the scientist will parachute in, grab some data, and then head back to the lab. And I think what you say makes perfect sense. They have no larger intimate context with the land and everything surrounding it.
Yeah, and I want to say this because, you know, if I don't say it now, I'll forget before we're done. One of the things that I think we really need to pay attention to is just that fact that the difference between people who are using satellite imaging, again, don't misunderstand me. I'm glad we have people who use satellite images. They can see things at that, you know, near outer space or outer space level of the Earth and its systems that we can't see when we're on the ground. But the converse is equally true. People who live on the ground in those places that satellite images are looking at, and then climate modelers are using to try to make some kind of calculation about what we might expect in the future. I think it's a tremendous mistake not to, as I say, ground truth the knowledge that those remote sensors gather with the knowledge, the experiential knowledge, the empirical knowledge that people who have lived there for hundreds, thousands of years have collected. And I think that's what's changing now, because I think a lot of scientists are beginning to get it and go like, oh, wow, that's right. These people have lived here for a long time. They probably know something about that place. And it's something that our satellite images can't necessarily convey. So we shouldn't pit one against the other. It's like we say, well, hey, both of these are useful, but, you know, in this case, more knowledge is better.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local productions of national interest. I'm Colleen MacDonald from Got Science, a podcast by the Union of Concerned Scientists in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Today, we're talking about traditional ecological knowledge. Now let's get back to my conversation with Dr. Wildcat. How can Western science and traditional ecological knowledge work together more closely than they have in the past?
You know, I'll be honest with you, that is a great question, and it's the most difficult one to answer. I think we're just starting to really negotiate what that looks like. I've been real involved with a group out of the National Center for Atmospheric Research in UCAR, University Center for Atmospheric Research, called Rising Voices. We're coming up, I think, on our 10th anniversary. And that was seen as a way we envisioned this Rising Voices group, as a way to bring climate scientists together with indigenous elders, those holders of community-held traditional ecological knowledges. Because again, we thought, you know, it's like two separate universes, and they don't talk to each other. So we started that discussion now for about a decade. And I think if you just look at what's going on in the National Science Foundation today with ideas about, you know, interdisciplinary science, and now we're even talking about convergence science, this idea that science isn't just, quote, the scientist, that you've got communities, you've got experts, you've got people who know something about a place that need to be involved. And I think that is all kind of part of what we can be hopeful about, that there does seem to be a realization that one of the missteps of science was a certain kind of ideology that, well, science is only for the scientist. And when I went to school, believe it or not, we were taught the scientific method. And that was, well, science is, the knowledge of science is born by a controlled experiment. Well, guess what? Most of the most serious problems we have today are what scientists would call wicked problems. We can't put them in an experimental box. We can't. There's no way we can control all the variables for the global phenomenon of climate change. But what we can do is we can say, you know, there are people on the Arctic Circle. There are people in the desert Southwest. There are people in the equatorial zones of our planet who've been there for hundreds and thousands of years. They know something about what's going on. And so they need to be included in the science. And I'm hopeful about that, but I think we're still kind of struggling to see exactly how that works.
I think for Western science, data collection is such a huge piece of that. How do we marry the two, the observational with the data?
Yeah, that's going to remain primarily, I think, an issue for the Western scientists, because I think what indigenous people would tell you, I've got a good friend, Merv Tano, who's been the director of the International Institute for Indigenous Resource Management for going on 20 years now in Denver, Colorado. And Merv is great. He says, you know, here's the issue. Our knowledge isn't data. We talk about talking story because so much of our knowledge is bound up in stories, in telling about something that happened and how it happened and what you saw, and of course, very most importantly, where. And that this talking story is so critical in indigenous traditions. And I do think that's one of the challenges. Data, when you think about converting something to data, what's the advantage of that? Well, data is portable. It's usable. You turn it into something that you can carry with you. And I think there is a problem with that with indigenous people who say, well, our knowledge isn't to be carried off. Our knowledge, if you find it useful, you can take it the way we offer it, but we're not necessarily interested in making it fit the kinds of boxes or graphs or charts that you work with or data sets. And so that's part of this negotiation that I think needs to take place.
Are there any principles or values you would recommend to guide closer collaboration?
I would say the first principle or the first value would be, and I have to be honest with you, probably one of the greatest gifts I've received from being around people like the late Albert Whitehead or the late Bill Tallbull, Northern Cheyenne elder, the legendary Billy Frank Jr. of the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, is their incredible sense of humility. And so I want to be very clear about this. I think we train scientists, and particularly PhD candidates and postdocs, to this mindset to where they're supposed to have the answer. And I think that it's all right not to have the answer, and that it would be great if more scientists came, as you mentioned earlier, to communities saying, we're here to listen. We're here to just find out from you what's important. And I do think that's a kind of humility about knowing that I don't think we do a very good job of inculcating in our formal institutions. No, you're supposed to know. And that's how you get a PhD, right? You come up with this one thing you're supposed to have discovered or know better than anyone else, and then you're the expert. Well, I think in indigenous traditions, the notion would be that no, you go into any kind of setting where you're trying to understand something with a position of humility and a keen awareness that the most important communication skill you need is that one of being able to listen and being mindful and attentive to the people, to the place, to the world around you. And that's not something our fast-paced, smart device society is very good at inculcating today. So that's part of the challenge.
How are tribal nations responding to the challenges of climate change? I mean, I've heard about salmon species in the Pacific Northwest that may go extinct because of climate change, and I'm sure you're seeing other impacts as well.
You can look at the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission. They have been able to maintain, you know, to a large extent, that salmon basis for their ancient traditions, that fishing basis. And I think with the threatening of the salmon, they have done the best job of sort of really saying, okay, we have to start taking action to address the warming of waters, the changes in water flow that might threaten salmon runs. And I think that they have done some of the best illustrations of how we should be using traditional ecological knowledge. And I think the analog to that is what you see now going on with this incredible focus now on restorations of tall grass prairies. So where I'm sitting in eastern Kansas, this is a big deal. Restoration of tall grass prairies and the reintroduction of bison. And I think those would be examples of people saying, we know we're not going to go back to the way it used to be, but by trying to approximate some of the ecosystem conditions that we had then, we might actually have a healthier planet restore habitats, have more biodiversity, and I think that's pretty good. Again, that to me is a good example of the way these traditional knowledges can be applied today to hopefully improve the life systems of our planet.
So are traditional ecological knowledges still being accumulated in the ways that your ancestors observed and passed down knowledge?
Yeah, I think that's been really threatened. You know, we're living right now through this horrible, well, I shouldn't say, when I say we're living, I think the general public is beginning to be aware of what the boarding schools meant for Indigenous people. So now, you know, Indigenous peoples have known for a long time how horrific the boarding schools were, not just to our children, but in terms of really threatening our very existence as Indigenous peoples.
And this was a program, this was a policy or a concerted effort to take children away from the tribe and put them in boarding schools as a way to strip them of their native heritage.
Yeah, but build them in the white man's image, you know, educate them in the white man's image. And so, yeah, thank you for contextualizing that. That's important. But all I wanted to say, in light of that, that boarding school trauma, the intergenerational transfer of that trauma, I'd be naive to say that some of those customary ways of telling stories and traditions weren't lost. I think some were, and they were seriously interrupted. But I think it's also true that even in areas that were the hardest hit, it's amazing how some of that continued, the language, the ceremonies. And so we can't make a blanket assessment of the well-being of TEK today, but here's the good news. If you understand TEK is our notion that Mother Earth has something to teach us if we're mindful. The good news is, in spite of all the things that humankind has done to the planet, she remains incredibly resilient. And my good friend and mentor, the late Vine Deloria Jr., would say she's waiting to find those humans who are ready to be mindful once again of their mother, the Earth, and pay attention to what her life systems can teach us human beings about how to be better relatives to the balance of life we share this planet with.
Well, that was very moving and inspiring. Dan, is there anything else that gives you hope?
So I've been fortunate, though. This past year, I've done several programs with K through 12 teachers. Now, I usually talk to scientists, right? People from NASA, people from NOAA, people from UCS. But talking to elementary teachers, I have really began to sense that they have this opportunity to begin to work with very young children to start introducing them to the way in which, you know, this world, things are all related, all interconnected. And as they start teaching science this way and getting children to understand these relationships right outside their door, okay, where they live, I think that's where the greatest hope is, because I think having this appreciation for the complex totality of the life systems that this Mother Earth represents gives you a window in to backing off from thinking that the solution is going to be one solution for everywhere.
Well, Dr. Wildcat, thank you so much for joining me. This has been a really fascinating conversation.
Well, Sanlay, thank you so much. It's been a joy to have this conversation with you.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to What Traditional Ecological Knowledge Can Teach Us. Our program's executive producer was Rich Hayes, with editing by Colleen MacDonald and Brian Middleton, and research and writing by Pamela Wirth. The show was hosted by me, Colleen MacDonald. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Colleen MacDonald from the Got Science podcast in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thanks for listening and see you next week on Sprouts.
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicar, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll look into the case of a goat, a girl, and the rise of more compassionate and humane alternatives to 4-H agricultural programs. We'll be speaking with Danielle Hanisch, executive director of LEAP, Leaders for Ethics, Animals, and the Planet. It's a program that offers students the farm animal care experience and opportunities of 4-H without the selling of those animals for slaughter, which can traumatize many kids.
These kids were, 14, 15, 16 years old and just realizing, like someone flipped a switch that, oh my gosh, these animals are no different than my dogs and cats at home. And now I'm knee deep in this program and I don't think that there's another option and I have to betray my friend who I have cared for.
We've got your goat. On the next Voices for the Animals, Friday, November 24th at 10 a.m., right here on 90.7 KBOO FM.